Who can tell me what the number one purpose of a business is? Yell out a few answers. What's the number one purpose of a business? To make money. To build wealth. To provide goods and services. Okay, those are all true. The point of business is to generate profit. The number one goal of a business is to generate profit. However, most of us spend much of our time thinking and dreaming about growing our gross revenue, or having a lot of clients, or having a lot of employees, or maybe that cool office that we intend to move into next. Imagine if you invested in my business. I start a new company, I ask you if you'll invest. You're not looking for a salary, you're not looking for a car allowance. What you want from me, from my business, is a return on your investment in the form of a quarterly distribution check for your share of the profit. You want profit. That's what you want most. Does anyone in here know the average net profit of a U.S. business? So what does the, and I'd like to have a few answers yelled out, what does the average U.S. company generate in the way of profit, percentage-wise? 20%, 35%, I think I heard 15%. Okay, thank you. If you'll hold that thought for a moment, I'm going to come back to that and I'm going to give you the answer. It's super easy to get distracted and forget that your number one responsibility, my number one responsibility as the owner or CEO of our business is to generate profit for our shareholders. If you own the business or part of the business, you're a shareholder. A lot of times when we think of shareholders, we think of public stocks. I buy a share of stock, I'm a shareholder in the company. But the reality is that if you are a business owner and you started a company, you own a share of that company. You are a shareholder in your business. You happen to work in the business and you happen to also own the business. I'd like to share an idea with you. Most of us are so busy fighting fires and growing our business at any cost that we fail to focus on what matters most. We are so consumed that we don't have time to stop and think. We don't have time to analyze what we're doing inside our company and then to set a strategy to possibly change what we're doing and improve upon what we're doing. Peter Drucker, the famous management consultant, said, "Management is doing things right. Leadership is doing the right things." We are all the leaders of our organizations. It's our job to analyze and strategize and make sure that our company is moving in the right direction. But the number one area that most of us owners fail in and fail to get on top of is the financial side of our business. We think more about marketing and sales. In fact, we generally think, most of us, that if we could just sell more, if we could bring more leads in and sell more to them, we could fix whatever our current problem is. But reality is that for most of us, especially in the early years of our business, selling more oftentimes just makes our problems, especially our financial problems, worse. When I started CityTurf, there was only one number that mattered to me, 1,000. I wanted 1,000 clients. That was my focus. It was such a huge mistake to make that my focus. 1,000 clients was a meaningless number, but that's what I was fixated on. That was my one number. And as a result, I made my decisions based upon that number. Now, I probably at the time would not have said I'm making unwise decisions because I've chosen the wrong number to focus on. I didn't have that clarity at the time. But what I did is, I didn't fire bad clients when I should have fired them, because if I fired that client, whom I was hoping I could fix, but I should have gave up on, that would affect my goal of hitting 1,000. Or if I discovered that in a specific market where we had 15 or 20 clients, we just really weren't making that much money because we had to send trucks all the way over there. I could go down and list all the reasons why maybe that market wasn't a great place for us to be as a company, yet I chose to continue operating in that underperforming market because if I fired those 15 to 20 clients, what would happen? That would affect my goal of hitting my magic 1,000. Or if I had a client and she owed me money, and if I happened to call her and say, can you please pay me my money for the fourth time, maybe she would get mad and she'd fire me. So I didn't really want to ruffle her feathers. I just continued to hope that she was going to pay me at some point in the future because, again, I didn't want to screw with my 1,000 goal, my goal of 1,000. And I'm a little dramatic in my example, but there's a lot of truth in what I just said. And I think it was especially true around collections. So the idea that I want to share with you is that there are three critical financial strategies that you cannot ignore. If you will work on these three things now, and you'll continue to work on these three things every year from now on for the remainder of your business career, you'll find a level of success and achieve a level of profit within your business that you can be extremely proud of. In spite of everything you might not know now, in spite of all the mistakes that you're going to make in the future, and please know that in the early days of my business, I did not know my financials. I was too busy, I was too overwhelmed, I was too stressed, I knew I should be looking at them. I had experience looking at my financials, yet that was the last thing that I did because there was just too many other fires, too many other things to deal with. But in spite of all of that, once I finally got my ducks in a row and focused on the three things that I'm about to talk to you about, it made a huge difference in our business. And I believe the reason we've been able to achieve a level of success, a level of profit, and a level of cash within our company that we have is because of these three strategies. I'm going to share them with you. They are one, the rule of 3 and 10 in cash management. Number two, the strategy of strategic quitting and job costing. And the concept of zero-based thinking and non-productive costs. Now, at the end of this talk, I'm going to give you cheat sheets for all of this. So I'm going to give you the big picture, the conceptual, the thought process. And I'm going to hold back the nitty-gritty detail process analysis side, but I'm going to give all of that to you. We're going to email it to you middle of next week after you've had time to get back to your office, get caught up, and then pay attention to the email when it arrives in your inbox. I'm sending all of this to you. So let's talk about the big picture. Next week, you can focus on digging in. So first, we need to get out of the way exactly what profit is, because everybody is running around with a different view of what profit actually means. Profit is the money that you make from all your sales, your revenue, minus all of your costs, your expenses, before you pay taxes. It's really pretty simple. It's revenue minus expenses equals profit. Most of us know that, all right? That's where we're usually all in agreement. So back in around, I guess it was around 05, I was a partner in a cleaning company and we focused on cleaning movie theaters. And we had an offer to sell the company. Our financials were analyzed. The price was determined. And that price was set at, if I remember correctly, 4.5 times free cash flow, minus debt. The only debt we had was some short-term debt in the form of a line of credit. So basically, the way to think about it is we were essentially getting 4.5 times our net profit minus whatever debt we currently owed on the line of credit. So we went through the due diligence process with the investment bank. They came in and interviewed us. They interviewed some of our key people. They went through our financials. They went through legal. They went through documents. They went through everything. And towards the end of the due diligence process, it was realized that officers' salaries were not included in the valuation. How? We have no idea, because our financials were right. Those numbers were in there. But somehow, during their analysis, they backed out our salaries. So as a result, they overstated the profit of the company. Now, this is a big deal, because when you took our salaries times 4.5 and you back that out of the offer, it was a significant amount of money. They revised the deal. It killed the deal. And that was the end of that. Now, in hindsight, it was a blessing because the company doubled in the next 3 years. But the reason I tell you that story is because it's critical to understand that your salary is not profit. If you sell your company and you stay, you still get paid a salary to help run the company. That is and remains an expense to the company. You're not free. If you sell your company and leave, and they have to replace you, they have to pay the next person a salary equivalent, more than likely, to what you were making before, a continued expense to the company. You get paid a salary to run and manage the company. You get paid your share of profits because you happen to also be an owner shareholder of the company. It's really important to understand the distinction. You play two roles in your business: salaried employee on the management team, shareholder who gets his share of the profits based on how well the management team executes. If you had an investor, they wouldn't get a salary. At least generally they don't. They don't help you run the company. They would only receive their share of distributions for the profit earned by the company, and they'd receive their share based on their percentage of ownership in the company. And then you'd receive your share based on your remaining percentage of ownership in the company. The better you and your management team do at running and managing the company, as again, as salaried employees of the company, the more profit you make because you, again, happen to also be shareholders. So knowing this, your top goal is to get yourself off the payroll as fast as you can. I said that wrong. Your top goal is to get yourself on the payroll as fast as you can. And as soon as possible, what you want to do is you want to be paying yourself a market-based salary. And when I say market-based, what would it cost to replace you with someone that could fill your shoes with your level of experience and knowledge? That's what you need to be getting paid as a manager of your business, as a CEO of your business. Now, the reality is that it takes a while to get to this point. It takes a while to get to the point where you can pay yourself a market-based salary, because the more you pay yourself, the less money you have to invest in your business and grow. So it's this delicate balance that you're fighting until you finally get the company big enough to be able to afford to pay you a fair salary, a market-based salary, and continue to grow quickly. Now, on a side note, your salary should eventually get capped at the same amount it would cost you to hire someone with your experience to do your job. Eventually, that becomes the ceiling of your salary. And you make the rest of your money as profits paid to you because, again, you're an owner, shareholder in the business. Now, once you finally arrive at this place, at the point where you're paying yourself a market-based salary, that net loss, net profit number down at the bottom of your P&L, it actually has meaning. Because prior to that, if you're paying yourself an unrealistically low salary, or you're not even on payroll at all, it makes your profit margins look really good. They're overstated. So generally, when you hear others talking about their profit margins, it's a meaningless conversation. Most people are not talking the same language. And most people don't calculate it correctly. So what's a good profit margin? I highly recommend a book by the name of Simple Numbers, Straight Talk, Big Profits. It's by Greg Crabtree. If you look it up on Amazon, it's got an orange cover on it. It's a simple, easy to read, understandable accounting book. I strongly encourage you to read that book. So in it, he says that if your business is making a 5% net profit margin, your business is essentially on life support. If your business is making 10%, you've got a good business. If you're making 15%, you've got a great business. If you're making greater than 15%, I'll put words in his mouth, you have an awesome business. In fact, it's so good that it probably won't last. Now, the reason that he says this is that the competition will eventually get wind of the fact that your market can afford to pay you a lot of profit. And as a result, more and more people will flood into that market. There'll be more and more competition, and they'll figure out better and different ways to do what you're doing for cheaper. And it will slowly drive down the price over time, which in effect will drive down profit. But my argument is there is a solution. Yes, most people will not achieve 15%. My argument is you can achieve 15% and you can achieve and you can exceed it, but it requires constant analysis, and a great strategic plan. And from what you learn doing your analysis, it requires innovating your business model. And we're going to touch briefly on this in a little bit. The best businesses operate at between 10 and 15%. One additional note about profit. If you're sitting there and you're doing the math and you're saying, you know what, I'm doing $300,000 a year and I'm already making 15%, or I'm making 22%, or I'm making 30%. Might it be that you're not paying yourself enough profit? Your margins look better than they really should. Two, what I've come to learn is that a very nimble business that is not growing super fast, when you're under $500,000 to $700,000, I don't know the exact number, your margins can look better than they really are. But as you start to grow the business, your expenses are going to increase. The faster you grow the business, the faster you have to spend money and hire more people. And that means your margins continue to get pounded by these expenses where you're having to hire people in advance so that you're ready for the growth that's coming. Also, when you're small, you have lower overhead. As you get bigger, you accumulate overhead. It just keeps getting added to the business. It's just the cost of running the business. And as a result, your margins start to dip. So earlier I asked the question, what is the average profit margin of a U.S. company? And the answer is, it's 6 to 8%. I personally don't think 6 to 8% is very exciting. However, give me a big enough business, and that's a lot of money. I think you can do better. I think you can be better than average. And that's what we're going to talk about. Strategy number one, you must be hardcore about cash management. Hardcore. Your job, my job as CEO, is to build the team, to find the team, build the team, to lead the team, and then to ensure that our company at all phases of growth has enough working capital. And you'll just simply think of working capital as cash. Working capital technically could also be short-term debt, such as a line of credit. But I'm not a big fan of a line of credit or using a line of credit. I'm not a big fan of that strategy. It works. And it's generally a more aggressive growth strategy. And you can use a line of credit and make a whole lot of profit, but it carries more risk. So I prefer working capital to be cash on hand. I just think it's a slightly safer strategy. It's not the rule book you have to follow. It's just the playbook that I've been using. So has anyone ever heard of the rule of 3 and 10? All right, the rule basically states this. Everything in the business, let's put it another way, everything in your business changes with every third and tenth step. So I'll explain that. So again, everything in your business changes with every third and tenth step. Let me give you an example, and we could use an example of people, or we could use an example of revenue. I'm going to go with people. So imagine, if you will, think back to the day when it was just you. You could do everything. You didn't have to delegate anything. You didn't have to explain yourself to anybody. If there was a problem, you dealt with it, and you dealt with it perfectly. If there was a sales objection, you dealt with it, and of course you dealt with that perfectly. And you were the master of your universe. Everything was great. And then one day you had three people. And now you have to explain yourself. Why are we doing this? Then you have to say no to people. Oh no, we can't do that, and here's why. And you can't sometimes just say no and be a dictator. You want to give an explanation. And then you had to learn how to be a delegator. It was a whole new set of experiences, and you had to learn a little bit in the process. Then your little organization grew from three people to 10. Big change again. Most of us can manage roughly about 7 people. That's our sphere of influence. That's what we can keep up with. In this case, you now have 10. So it's you. You probably also need a manager to help you. You're getting to that place. Well, that's a new scenario. You've got to impart your wisdom to this manager. You need to have an internal training procedure. You need to have your manager train your team at the same level that you trained your team. Maybe you train the manager and then the manager trains the team. Your manager isn't a perfect copy of you. And as a result, the team doesn't get trained at quite the same level. The new folks that come into the team don't know the history of the company quite like those that joined the company first. Changes things, creates a little disruption. creates a little chaos, a few problems. Then you go from 10 people to 30 people. Well, 30 people, you don't get to talk to everybody anymore. When it was 10, you knew everybody. I mean, of course, at 30, you still know everybody's name, but at 10, you could have conversations. You could chat with them almost every day. You could say hi every single day. They sort of knew what you were thinking, sort of knew where everything was at, what was going on in the company. Now, at 30 people, it's a different beast. You can't have those personal relationships. You can't have the same level of conversation. Not because you don't want to, it's just now impossible because you have to play CEO and fulfill your daily duties. You don't have time for all of that, to have 30 individual conversations all the time. As a result of that and so many other things, there starts to appear more and more cracks in the company. Customer service issues, quality issues. This is where training becomes ridiculously important. But have you trained your team to even be able to train? Internal communication isn't working so great anymore. You're now having to figure out how to be a better communicator. And then you go from 30 to 100. Imagine that. I mean, imagine how many things now break at 100. Simple things like the phone system. The phone system used to work. We used to be able to use a simple voice over IP system. Nothing works at 100. Some of the technology we were using, that doesn't work. We were using some Excel spreadsheets that we had customized with some formulas, and how in the world do you pass those spreadsheets amongst a group of people? It's just, you can go down the list. Everything's breaking. Everything's falling apart. And at this point, you can't actually do any work as the owner, CEO of the company. Like, none. All you can do is have meetings and delegate and lead and guide, but you can't actually do anything because you've got a whole team to coach and manage. You've got managers to manage at this point. So after each stage of growth, there's this period where you have to go through and fix and refocus. You've got to do a little cleanup. You've got to fix your processes, rebuild some processes. It's challenging. Well, during the 1 million to 5 million revenue range, you go through what's called the wilderness period of your business. This is a time when you're experiencing lots of threes and tens. You're bumping into ceilings. You're running into bottlenecks. You're getting stuck. You're not sure how to make customer service better. You're not sure how to bring more employees onto the team faster and get them up and running. You're not sure how to solve some of the many issues that you're having as an organization. You're bumping into all these challenges. And you've got to overcome these things to get out of this wilderness period. So what else happens? The stakes go up. Your risks go up. Now you're aware of this asset that you've built and the value of this asset and all the people and families that are depending on you. You become very aware that we better have all our ducks in a row when it comes to licensing. Are we paying all of our taxes on time? Are we saving enough? Are we up to par on all of our taxes? Are we in full compliance? Is there any government reporting that we're not reading in full and not dealing with? Oh, wow, now we have so many employees, we have to offer health care. Now we've got HIPAA. We've got all these new regulations and rules, all these things we could get in trouble for. We've got insurance. Are we handling workers' comp correctly? Are we doing our general liability correctly? Do we have key man life insurance policies on the owners, the most important people in the company? What about safety? What if somebody gets in an accident? What happens? Who could sue us? I mean, you can go down the list. All of these things legitimately become a really big deal because a few of these things could cost you your business or at least a couple years of your profit. So you really want to have all your ducks in a row. Well, all of this requires people. It requires systems. It requires management. I've been through this phase 3 times, and I firmly believe that it gets a whole lot easier on the other side of $5 million. I've also seen that profits improve after this phase. To get through this wilderness period, the $1 to $5 million time period, you need max cash. You need max cash to get through this phase. Because this is when you're going to notice the most pressure on your profits. This is when they're going to dip. This is when you're going to be at the biggest risk of hitting a bottleneck and stagnating or declining or maybe dissolving and going away. So as a strategy, I strongly, strongly recommend leaving every dime of your profit in your business through $5 million. And I realize that is not a popular thing to say. That's not exciting. There's just nothing popular about that idea. I recommend that you pay yourself a very fair wage so that you can live comfortably and focus on your business, so that you can take care of your family, but you can be focused on the business. That's what I did at City Turf, and it's exactly what we did at Service Autopilot. So I lived exactly what I'm recommending. So for many years, you're going to sacrifice the fat paycheck, but here's one comforting thought. All that money that you're leaving in the business in the form of profit, it's all still your money. It's yours. But it's your safety net. It's your pad. It's building a cash reserve so that if a fantastic opportunity presents itself someday, you can capitalize on it. It's building a cash pad that if there's a massive economic decline, you can weather that, maybe even buy up all your competitors. A lot of opportunity comes with having cash. So remember, you get paid a salary to manage the company. You get paid profits for your investment in the company. If you think like an investor, do you want your management team to risk your investment by paying themselves big fat salaries too early? No way. As an investor, you want to do everything possible to build an asset as quickly as you can that's taken care of financially, safe and secure, and is in a position to be able to spin off big fat profit checks to you in the future. Smart investors take a long-term perspective on this. They're willing to sacrifice short-term profits to make really big profits later. So this talks about profit. I'm talking about cash. If you want to make a lot of profit, you need a lot of revenue. It takes a lot of cash to grow a big business. So for proof that having cash, that cash should be one of your focuses, consider how a bank thinks. Banks value cash flow over large profits because they understand that your profits can grow and they can grow substantially while your cash declines, which is why they need to give you a line of credit. And they also understand that you can go out of business while making really fat profits. You basically run yourself out of working capital, and at some point, the bank chooses not to lend you more short-term debt or possibly long-term debt, and that's the end of you. So what's cash flow? Cash flow is basically a change in your cash balance over a period of time. So you have cash coming in the form of revenue, and you have expenses going out. That's cash flow. And your goal is to keep your cash balances as high as absolutely possible. That's why you'll hear the saying, I need to speed up my cash flow. What's happening is their bank balance is declining. Their cash balance in their bank is slipping. They need money to come in faster so that they can keep that bank balance up so they have plenty of money to float their business and pay their expenses. Knowing that your top expense within your business is probably payroll, one of the savviest ways to solve this problem is to line up your payroll with your receivables. And this is why I'm such a huge proponent of using credit cards. This is why we recommend BluePay, who's here with us. Because I'm willing to sacrifice a few percentage points in merchant fees to ensure that I can get paid very fast. So if I can have all my money, my revenue coming in at the beginning of the week and my payroll going out at the end of the week, I've lined up my biggest expense with my income so that I don't have to float a lot of money. And I need high cash balances to be able to grow my company fast. And this is why as you get big, it becomes really important to forecast your cash flow. And it's really, the concept's not that difficult. Basically, with cash flow, what's happened is you've made promises to vendors, to your employees, to make payments or to pay them on some certain date out in the future. Your clients have made promises to you that they will pay you by some date out in the future. And your forecast is basically looking at if you, the company owner, if the company honors its promises and commitments and your clients honor their promises and commitments, this is how much money you should have on some date out in the future. So how do you put yourself in a position that you're focused on profit, but to get to or to achieve the ability to build big profits and maintain big profits, you're focused on keeping enough cash and managing your cash flow properly so that you can grow quickly, so that you can experience the profits. I have three suggestions for you. Well, I just gave you one. I'm going to give you three more. And one was figure out how to speed up your cash flow, period. That's your job. Use credit cards to do it or accept credit cards or figure out how to get paid in advance, but work on that problem. How can you speed up your cash flow so you're getting paid faster and you're getting paid before you have to pay out your weekly payroll? Scenario number one, I highly recommend that you do something within your organization where you put the focus on profit. Remember, my focus was on 1,000 and it was a flawed focus. So what I suggest is that you set up a bank account that you move profit into. And I'm not going to give you all the details because, again, I'm going to give you a cheat sheet to work through this, but I'm going to give you the outline. And the outline is this. You want to set up a bank account that you move your profits into weekly, biweekly, on some period of time. And this concept is swiped from the personal finance industry based on the concept of pay yourself first. I've never liked the concept of pay yourself first, ever, because to me, that was always an attitude of, oh, I have now created a business and I'm going to figure out how I can extract as much money from my business as fast as I can so that I can live a big fancy lifestyle. And I know that's not really what it means, but that's what I feel like I see with those running around with the attitude of, I should get paid first. So I've been anti that. I've been long-term investor focused. How about we sacrifice some profit and pay now so that I can have put the money back in the business and have big profits later. So that was my attitude. But now I understand that maybe the better approach would have been to have my most important number that I focused on something related to profit. So this is a very, very simplistic concept. But the reason I like the concept of every month, or let's put it this way, every week, taking some amount of profit off the table. And maybe it's just 5% to get started. Maybe it's 1% to get started. The reason I like that is that zeroes your mind into focusing on profits. Because if the money you have remaining in the business can't pay the bills, it highlights a problem. But it trains you to focus on profit. It trains you to do what I recommend, which is leave as much profit in your company through $5 million. So you're moving profit over to this account, which is building your safety net. It's building your pad. Second, give yourself a backup plan. If you're a Dave Ramsey fan, and I like Dave Ramsey, I think he's done a world of good for our country, in a sense, and for people that are in debt or have been tempted by a lot of debt. However, I disagree with the concept of not having a credit card, or of having a credit card. And here's a test for yourself. If in your life you've been able to be a fairly decent financial steward and you have very minimal credit card debt and you've been able to put off spending money, you can handle a credit card. And maybe you couldn't do that in the past, but you've matured now and now you can. And so if you're that person and you can handle having the potential to access debt, then I strongly encourage that you get yourself the highest limit credit card you can get and you put it in a drawer. And I suggest that you take that line of credit from the bank and pay them their $100 a year, whatever it costs to maintain that line of credit, and give yourself a backup plan. Because if you do take the debt elimination route and you pay cash for your trucks and you pay cash for your equipment, you're really driving down your cash balance. And that's risky because remember, one of our top goals as CEOs is to keep our cash balance as high as possible, to set our companies up for maximum success. So if you pay down all of your debt, which I'm not saying you shouldn't, you're hurting cash. It's as plain and simple as that. So if you're going to have that strategy, What if something happens in the economy or some really bad event happens to you? You could be at risk of losing your company if you don't have a backup plan. That credit card, that line of credit might be your backup plan that could at least keep your company from going under. Third, if you're a slow-growing company, use another concept from the personal finance industry, and that is pay all of your bills and deposit all of your money on the 10th and 25th of every month, and then handwrite your cash balance in your bank account every Friday. Write it on paper and learn that number. Know in your mind at any moment about where you should be from a cash balance standpoint. If you're a fast-growing company, I recommend you pay your bills, make your deposits once a week, every single week. Do your accounting once a week. And write down your daily cash balance on a sheet of paper every single day and learn that number. If you run a daily cash balance of roughly, let's call it 120 grand, and all of a sudden you write that number down on a Thursday and it's 72,000, you might have a moment of panic and that might tell you you need to dig into something. Learn that number. It's your responsibility. The amount of cash that you are able to build in this profit account, or if you don't use that concept, that you're able to build and maintain within your business is directly related to the amount of profit that you're generating as a company. So if you're not building much cash, you're not really generating profit. Generally, the biggest destroyer of profit in our company is at the job level. Our job is to make sure that when we sell work, we price that work correctly. And then when we execute on that work, to make sure that we're executing efficiently. If we're not doing that, if we're not selling it correctly and we're not executing correctly, we're killing the margins of our business. And if you want to achieve profit margins of 15%+ versus the 6-8% that a typical U.S. company makes, we have to be certain that we're selling the right work to the right clients at the right price. So what happens when we realize that we aren't doing the right work and we're not selling it to the right clients and we're not selling it at the right price? The answer is strategic quitting. So most of us are completely adverse to the concept of quitting. We got here by fighting and pushing and, you know, basically fighting it out and scrapping it might have been the better choice of words. That's how we got here. So this concept of quitting is foreign to us. But reality is, most of us fall into two groups when it comes to quitting. One is we practice reactive quitting. So we're the group that we get mad. We're pissed at that employee. We're tired of this kind of client. And because of that client, we're going to implement this new policy and we're not going to do this thing. Because of this employee, we're going to implement a new procedure in our handbook and we're not hiring anybody like that person ever again. In fact, I want them off my team. You can go down the list of things that we react to as owners because we're pissed, we're stressed, we're tired, we're frustrated. And as a result of these overreactions, these quick reactions, we do silly things to our business that sabotage our current profits, our long-term profits, and our long-term growth. This is why you see a lot of owners sell off part of their business or exit the business completely only to get back into it later. Or this is why so many of us are tempted by the company we see down the street doing some service that we don't do, and we say, you know what? I need to be in that service because I hate the services I'm in. There's no money in these things, and so we move our business that direction. Well, that may be perfectly logical. You might should be in that service, but I'm saying that most of us are always looking at somebody else's business saying, wow, it's so much better over there. I got to get over there. And so we're doing dumb things with what we've already got in hopes of trying to get over there. And then when we get there and we start selling that service, it goes great at first, and eventually we bump into some bottlenecks and roadblocks, and maybe we're running through that wilderness period of our company, and oh, wow, this service sucks too. And then we repeat that cycle. I'm simply saying that slowing down and being strategic versus emotional versus reactive is the way to go. Or there's a second group. And the second group is, I will never give up. I will figure this out. I will work harder. Success will follow. And so I will not quit, period. Strategic quitting is about analyzing your jobs, understanding what's going on in your market, understanding what might be coming out in the future, creating a strategic plan, not guessing, not reacting, creating a plan, and then executing that plan over a period of time. So I want to give you a few examples of the analysis that you might want to perform. But again, I'm going to give you all of this in detail next week. So a question you might ask yourself is, what should we focus on? Is there a particular service with more margin? Maybe it's a service we're not offering, but it's a service where we could make more profit within our business. Or maybe there's a geographic area where we've noticed that we can more easily sell new clients in this area. And when those clients buy, we can sell more service back into them. They have a higher lifetime value. Whereas there's this other geographic area where it's so much more difficult. Our conversion rate's lower. They never buy anything else. They cause us more trouble. An example of focusing might be we strategically quit marketing in this area. We spend our money over in this area. That's strategy. That's analysis and strategy. That's wise strategic quitting. Or another example of maybe something we should quit is we've been doing all these one-times for years, and we needed the one-times at a point in time because they filled in the gaps in our schedule, and we were just scraping by, scrapping it out, trying to get to a place where we were financially viable as a company. But now, in analyzing our one-times, they don't really generate us that much money. We put in all this work and effort, and we deal with all these problems and all these stresses, and generally, we make sacrifices to provide great customer service to the one-times while we neglect the clients that pay us recurring every week and pay us a whole lot of money. Might it be time that we don't continue with one-times? Or maybe we have a fertilization weed control program, 7 applications, and for Ms. Smith, yes, I'll do the 4 weed treatments and not the fertilization. And Mr. Jones, yeah, I know, you don't want 3 fertilizations, I'll do 2. And as a result, we get callbacks and redos and complaints, and our trucks sit in front of ugly properties. How's that working out for us? Those are the questions we want to ask ourselves. Are we constantly dealing with these problems? Maybe we should quit. Again, not get mad, but strategically think it through and quit. And focus our resources, our time and money on something else. One more. Maybe something's just not working. Maybe you send techs or crews to commercial properties at the beginning of the week and you send them to residential properties at the end of the week. And now your residential quality is suffering because at the beginning of the week, you tell your crew, hey, here's the budget hours. Here's how we sold the contract. You need to kind of pick up the pace. And then when they get to the residential property, they continue that pace where it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Now we need to slow down that pace and focus on quality over here. Doesn't work. Might that be a scenario, as an example, that's just not working? Or maybe you're knocking on doors because when you're about to perform the job because Miss Smith said, can you please mow my lawn, but be here before noon because I babysit my granddaughter and I don't want you to wake her up. And every freaking Thursday, something goes wrong and you're barely getting there by noon. And it's just a constant battle and it costs you money. Maybe it's not worth making all the exceptions. Maybe those aren't the best clients for your business. So as you do this analysis, as you ask these hard questions, you modify your business model and you say, you know what? This isn't the geographic area for us. This service is not making us enough money. Let's quit marketing and promoting that. Maybe we need to continue it for now, but we're going to quit talking about it. This service over here, we're going to get really trained up on it. In fact, we're going to bring in some people that know what they're doing on this service. And over the next 2 years, strategically, we're going to start really getting great at this and pushing it. And we're going to spend a lot of our marketing on that service. That's where we're going as a company. These are examples of modifying your business model. So we just went through asking yourself some questions, maybe making a little bit strategic, planning your strategy. How do you figure out what to quit in your business versus fix? Well, you start by looking at what is working and what isn't working. And this is where we get into job costing. So again, I'm going to give you the cheat sheets in the process. And so I'm only going to give you a 3-4 minute overview here because I'm sending all of this to you. But here's how it works. You start with job costing. The key to initially getting your profits where you want them is to exit whatever you shouldn't be doing and get focused, refocus. And then daily, you want to watch your numbers and you want to ensure that you're hitting your targets. And I'm going to show you how to hit those targets, or I'm going to explain how to figure out the targets. The larger the dollar value, the more information you need to track and cost about that job. So for example, if you're doing small residential mowing or cleaning or whatever, your biggest expense is labor. you can probably predominantly just cost out the labor on that job to see if you're hitting your benchmarks. But if you're doing a $35,000 installation job, you better be costing out more than labor. You got to be looking at equipment cost, material cost, lots of other factors. If you can't make your job profitable when you're on site, meaning you can't, from the minute you turn off the ignition, the minute you turn it back on, for that period of time, you can't make that job profitable, then nothing you can do externally to that job will fix the problem, will fix that job. If your jobs are not profitable, nothing you can do will fix the company. You have to get the jobs profitable. If your jobs are not profitable, the faster you grow, the faster you deplete your cash, the faster you run up your debt, probably in the form of a line of credit, and potentially, eventually, you go out of business. When money's tight, a lot of us think the solution is to go sell more. If we can sell more work, we can dig ourselves out of this hole. But if we're not selling profitable work, we can get ourselves into a whole lot more trouble. We can make our problem worse. And that's why you start at the job level. So the way we start at the job level is we start watching all of our numbers. Literally, we're recording and tracking time for every job we do. And every day, we're looking at all of the jobs that we've performed, all of the different services we performed, and we're starting to get a feel for what we make per man hour on all of these jobs. We're much like logging your bank balance by hand, we're just getting a feel. We're starting to understand what's happening inside our business. Then we go out to the properties and we look at our top performers. We stand on the property and we look at the makeup of the property. We look at who on our team is performing that work. We look at how they're performing that work. We're just paying attention to everything about that property and everything that's going on. And then we go and we look at our bottom performing properties. We observe the property. It's the exact same process. We observe who's at the property. How do they work? Everything about it. We pay attention to it. We make notes, mental and on paper. And we start to look for clues. What's not right? Where could we improve? Why is this job better than that job? And then once we figure this out, and we start to figure out what a good job should be making in terms of a man-hour rate, we start to set targets by service type to achieve that man-hour rate at every property. And we work to fix the underperformers. So daily we're reviewing these numbers against our targets, and slowly we're fixing the underperforming jobs, and we're dropping the losers that we can't fix. And we increase the prices that we sell work at to make sure that we're selling work that has the potential to hit our targets. And then eventually, across the board, we're hitting all of our numbers on all of our jobs. Then daily we apply management to this problem, to ensure that we continue to hit our numbers day in and day out. And over time, management's responsibility is to figure out how to make us even more margin on these jobs, to get the numbers up, to improve them. That's their job. That's the job of management. So again, I'm going to be sending you the questions to ask yourself about your jobs and the process to follow to analyze those so that you can figure this out. The third step. So cash, job costing, number three. After ensuring your jobs are achieving your target profit margin, we want to focus on your non-productive costs. These costs are a lot harder to find. They're hidden all throughout your P&L report. The waste that you're experiencing with these non-productive costs, it doesn't nicely bunch itself up into expense categories on your profit and loss statements. It's hidden in field labor, it's hidden in office labor, it's hidden in management and officer pay, it's hidden in your payroll, it's hidden in your materials, your repair expense, your gas expense, your supply expense. It's hidden all over the place in your P&L. I love this quote. All expenses are either investments in more profit or failures of management. All expenses are either investments in more profit or failures of management. And that basically says that for every dollar you spend on something, it should go out and bring you back more revenue and, as a result, more profit. And if that's not what's happening when you spend that money, when you incur that expense, management in some way is dropping the ball. It's really, really difficult to live that day in and day out. Our businesses are growing really fast. It's really challenging to perfectly manage our people, to manage all the resources available to us, to manage all of our expenses, and not make mistakes, and make sure that we're spending money on things that have the highest probability of making us more money. It's just ridiculously difficult. But to make everything so much worse, we as owners are so attached to the ups and downs of our business, so personally attached. This thing is our baby. We feel the good and the bad of everything in our business. We feel the complaints of our clients. We feel the frustration with our team. We're really attached to this thing because it's so personal to us. And as a result, it makes it really difficult for us as owners to make really wise business decisions. It's very difficult to step back and look at our businesses with fresh eyes. So let me give you an example. If you would, imagine that you have a middle school friend. Imagine a name. Now imagine that this person, through the years, has become a drain on your energy. They're negative. They're dramatic. Controversy constantly follows them. And they, several times a year, invite you to get together, to go out and do something. And every time, it's like, ah, crap. And you're not excited about it. Another Facebook message, you really don't want to do it, but you know what? You've got a past history with them. I really should go do this. Should you really continue that relationship or should you end it? Another example. Imagine that you bought a home in 2007 for $300,000. Now, it's early 2009. It's worth $240,000. New development. You've got a kid on the way. And crap. Back in 07, you weren't so concerned about the school district. You were just really excited about the great deal and the cool house. But now, first kid, overprotective parent, we need them in the best school district. But the best school district is kind of out of sight right now because we're $60,000 underwater. However, you have a feeling that if you were to buy a house in that other market, that house will probably appreciate faster over there. What should you do? Should you sell your house and move to the other neighborhood where your kid can go to the best school? And hopefully your house, the money that you lost on this house, will be recovered in appreciation faster in that new neighborhood? What would you do in each of these situations? There's a concept, and it's called zero-based thinking. It's also known as the sunk cost fallacy. And it basically states this. Your decisions are tainted by your emotional investments that you accumulate. And the more you invest in something, the harder it becomes to abandon it. Here's a question that sort of frames what I just said. Knowing that you can ask of yourself, knowing what I now know, would I buy that house in that neighborhood? Would I ask this person to be my friend or develop a friendship with this person? I'll come back to that. I first learned this concept but didn't have a name for it when I was in high school. So by the time I finished my freshman year of college, I had bought and sold 14 cars, and on only one of those, I lost money. I basically bought the cars, drove them for some period of time, and then I'd turn a profit on these cars. Somewhere along the way, I got the advice that when you go to buy a car, you want to suck up as much time of the person selling the car as absolutely possible. So if you're at the dealership, suck up 3 hours of the guy's time. Ask him questions, drive the car, just suck up the time. Then negotiate the deal. He's not going to want to lose the deal because he's not going to want to have wasted the last 3 hours of his day. The strategy worked. At least it worked for me. And so I followed it. Well, I didn't understand that that's the sunk cost fallacy or the zero-based thinking concept. But it was. So if you buy into that concept, and I do, then you should cut off that friend. Because knowing what you now know, that friend is not good for you. They're not what you want out of life. Knowing what you now know, you should sell your house, take the loss, go buy in the neighborhood that has the chance to recover your loss, and get your kid into the best school. The problem is most of us can conceptualize this, but emotionally, we're almost restricted from taking action and doing what we need to be doing. And we do exactly the same thing every day inside our business. The reason I brought this concept up is we're moving into this world of rapid technology breakthroughs. We're living in it now. It's only going to increase. Technology and the startups that want a piece of your business do not give a flip about the way it's been done in the past, how you do it, how you think it should be done, how I think it should be done. They're here to break everything and change the rules. So if you hang on too tight to how it is or how it was or how you think the future might be, ignoring everything that's coming, you're going to get passed by. But there's never been a time ever in history that you have such a big opportunity to break into your market, that you have such a huge opportunity to overtake the top players in your market. However, this opportunity is also your risk. There's no greater time in history that your competitors can come do exactly the same thing to you. So zero-based thinking challenges you to question everything. How do you apply this business, this thinking to your business? Well, one example is you ask this question about everything in your business all the time. If I was creating the perfect new company, would I do this? Would I buy this thing? Would I have bought this piece of equipment? Would I do this process this way? Would I hire this person? For example, if I was starting a new business from scratch and leaving my old one, would I bring Bob with me to start the new company? If the answer is no, that's pretty telling about Bob. Maybe he shouldn't continue being on the team. You want to question all of your non-productive costs, and you want to use zero-based thinking to do it. So when I say non-productive costs, what I'm referring to, it's all the costs that you incur to produce the work. But these costs don't get directly invoiced. They don't show up as line items on the invoice. Drive time, load time, unload time, maintenance, gas, brakes, supplies, parts runs. These things are, yes, built into the price that you're charging. They're built into the rate. Yes, they're built into the hourly rate that you're selling work at. They're averaged into the time that you're selling. But as you grow, these non-productive costs inflate. If you're not constantly watching them, they'll grow and your margins will shrink. So if you're not constantly paying attention to and increasing and adjusting your rates, your pricing, as your costs increase, then your profits will drop. They'll start to shrink. These non-productive costs are also your competitive advantage because most of your competitors are not paying attention to these expenses. These expenses are happening to them. But if you can hold your rates steady and slowly increase your rates while you pound hard on lowering your non-productive costs, then you can really grow your profit. Example, assuming that your business operates at break-even or better, for every dollar you drive out of your business of non-productive costs, it's a dollar that goes straight to the bottom line in the form of profit. And even better, for every hour that you save a technician, you can go resell that time. You are already paying him because you were wasting his time before. You've probably already recovered your overhead on him. So the time that you recapture and resell is ridiculously profitable work. Most of that time, so if you sell him at $50 a man hour, a lot of that $50 falls straight to the bottom line to your profit. This is where you can really start to see some big increases in your profit margins. So there's a process that you can follow to figure out these non-productive costs and work on them. You've got to go through some analysis. I'm going to give that to you. It's a process similar to what you'll do with your jobs. So the idea is that you want to brainstorm. You first want to sit down, you want to brainstorm and list out all your non-productive costs in your business. Then you want to go out into the field and you want to stand in the yard in the morning and you want to stand in the yard in the evening and you want to watch everything that's happening. And you want to identify all the little leaks in your business, all the non-productive costs, and you want to note them. You want to write them down. You want to pay attention. And then you want to create and rank these non-productive costs. You want to apply, in a sense, the 80-20 rule to this, and you want to work on the first one, the biggest one first. And you want to work on them one at a time. And for every non-productive cost, you want to ask yourself a set of questions. So as an example, here's an example of asking some questions about one of the most common non-productive costs, filling up the truck with gas. Why do we all send our trucks to the gas station in the morning when all of our competitors are there and every employee of every company in the city is getting their coffee? Why do we want to send our crews there to get their water, their ice, their breakfast snack and their lunch and fill up the truck and chat and wait in line for 15 minutes. What if instead we only filled trucks at night on the way home when they don't have anything to buy and the only thing they want to do is get off the clock and go home for the day? How much money would that save us? So what we're looking for is, we're looking for all of our biggest offenders, the areas where we are incurring the most expense, and we want to go to work on that. We want to figure out how to eliminate that expense or reduce that expense or innovate in some major way to drive that expense down in a massive, massive way. We initially make a pass through all of our big offenders and we work on them. And then every year we come back around and we pound on these expenses. We go through the same process, same analysis every year. So when it comes to the jobs, when it comes to cash management, when it comes to your non-productive costs, you're doing this every year. At this time every year, you're planning out the next year and you're planning out how you can drive more cost out of your business, how you can become more efficient. I'm going to give you all of this. You'll get it next week. But that's the big concept. That's the big overview. That's what you need to be focused on and working on to make sure that you hit the 15% plus margins, to make sure that you have enough cash to get through the wilderness period inside your company. So let's imagine that you follow my advice. You work really hard. And working really hard means that at times you have to sacrifice some time away from your friends, your family, your hobbies. You finally make it to that $1 million mark, which I think is one of the hardest phases of business, one of the hardest phases to get to. You're now on payroll. You're paying yourself a fair market-based salary. And then you survive the wilderness period, 1 to 5 million. And during that period, you save all of your profit. You build it up in your bank account as a cash cushion. Now, during this time, because you're living on a fair salary, your family doesn't live an extravagant lifestyle, but you live a comfortable lifestyle. Your focus is on the business. It's on getting to the bigger goal. Now, to get through this $1 to $5 million wilderness period, you've had to tweak the business plan a few times. You've had to do a lot of analysis and strategize. You've had to think critically about where the future of your business is, and you've had to guide your business in that direction. And you've constantly worked on cash management. You've constantly, day in and day out, paid attention to your jobs. You've constantly pounded hard on driving non-productive costs out of your business. And along the way, you've also suffered the frustration of sucking at being a manager and not being a great leader, at having to learn how to become a better communicator and not being a great CFO to your company. But you've sucked it up. You showed up every day. You've done the work. You read, you learn, you find other entrepreneurs who are doing it, who are where you're at now or ahead of you, and you spend time with them and you learn from them and they give you energy and you keep going. And day in and day out, you work on yourself to become a better person. And all of this could take years. Actually, it will take years. Is it worth it? Wouldn't it just be easier to build an average company that sort of slowly grows, that eventually makes you $750,000, $1 million a year? Maybe you make $75,000, $100K a year take home. You're doing okay. You don't really have to do too much work on yourself. You can sort of be who you've been all your life, not really grow your skill set too much, and you can get there over time with a long enough time horizon. You can keep your hand on everything in the business. You can you delegate some stuff, but you don't have to delegate too much. You're still the core of decision making. It's just not as challenging. And you have a little bit more time, maybe. So is it worth it to go for the bigger margins, go for the bigger business? I hope your answer is yes. I hope it's yes. Because there's four really awesome things that come from the journey. You become a better person. It's sort of like having kids. Kids just make you a little bit less selfish. If you want to build a bigger company that's efficient, highly profitable, you have to be a great boss. You have to be a great CEO. You have to truly care about and worry about your team and care about their future. Because if you don't, you're not going to retain that team long enough to help you build the company to get you to where you need to go. So you have to work on yourself to be a better leader, better communicator, better manager. Number two, you develop a lot of confidence. You become a better financial steward of your company. You become a better builder of businesses. After all, you've done it. When you make it to that $5 million mark, and I'm not saying you have to make it there, but when you go down that journey, you learn how to do it. If the economy and everything around us melts down and tanks, you'll eventually be able to rebuild. You'll know how to rebuild. And you'll probably be equipped to rebuild faster than your competitors. If you one day sell your company and you're bored out of your mind, you can go start another one. You can do it again. Three, wealth. In my example, we're fighting for 15% minimum net profits at scale, meaning at around a $5 million plus company. Just that was my example. Again, you don't have to go, that doesn't have to be your ambition. But if you do the math on that, 15% of $5,750,000 a year in profit, you're probably making $1 to $120,000 a year in salary. You didn't take cash out of your business all the way to $5 million. You've built a substantial pad. That's your money. It's sitting in the account. You're now making a really, really nice living that you can do a lot of work, a lot of good stuff with. So you accomplish wealth, the building of wealth. That is one purpose of business. But most important, maybe it's because of the age I'm at this point in life. Maybe it's just based on where I'm at in life. But to me, the most important one is this. Day in and day out, I want to live the example of what I want my kids to become and how I want my kids to think. I want them to see hard work firsthand. I want them to see and know without question that there is a world of opportunity and possibility waiting for them if they'll do the work, if they'll go to work on themselves and they'll work really hard to become smarter, better, more intelligent, wise decision makers. And I don't want this for them so that they can make tons of money so they can go out and buy tons of crap that they won't care about in 6 months. I want them to make enough money and accumulate enough wealth so that every day they can ask themselves, knowing what I now know, would I live in this city? Knowing what I now know, would I work this job? Knowing what I now know, would I be building this company? Knowing what I now know, would I be in this relationship? And if the answer is no, they can walk away. That's freedom. And that's why you and I build businesses. It's worth the journey. It's worth the work. Go do the work. Thank you very much.